Okay, we're ready to start the show as far as the questions and answers and the roundtable give and take. Courtney, do you remember what Russell brought up you thought was interesting about 30 minutes ago? Probably not.
Yeah, it was why science hasn't accepted this. Mainstream science doesn't accept the case for Psi.
Okay, let's get that around on the panel here.
And actually, I already commented on that, and Lynn already commented on that.
Well, yeah.
But go ahead. Yeah, but that was...
Some conspiratorial-minded people have said, and I wouldn't say that I subscribe to this, but some would say that those in control of things don't want us to know the truth about ourselves, and they're the people that fund scientific research. I've been a medical reporter for many years, and I learned about simple things like nutrition, and I realized that this is rarely studied in scientific in a scientific setting, because the funding is provided by the drug companies. So they're going to look at drug research, not nutritional research. Who controls the scientific funding? And yeah, it's a paradigm. It's a paradigm shift. A lot of castles will crumble when they admit remote viewing is real.
I would like to add that since I work at the university, I get to look at these people in the face. And it really is a very deep gap between what they are doing and what they would have to acknowledge if they accepted the reality of remote viewing. These people really don't want to discuss it. They really do block it out. Because you'd have to really say, with all of the research that's been done over the decades, even early research that was done in the early labs at PAIR and SRI International, that was enough to demonstrate the reality of remote viewing. But if you add what's happened since then, it's way overkill. So you really have to look at who these people are. I understand the conspiratorial component to it, and there may be something to it on the level of governmental operations. But on the level of the academy, on the level of the university, I don't think the government's involved in that. It really is a psychological issue on the level of the academics themselves.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We got a lot of people been holding on for a while. Caller, are you there? 937.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, what do you have to say? Do you have a question for these scholarly people?
This is Teresa Frisch here. I'm well known to the panel, most of them. Russell may know me if he thinks about it. Hi, everybody. You're doing a great job.
Hi, good evening.
Hi. I am a student of Lynn's, and I'm also a graduate of his analyst program. And so I was possibly thinking that I could dialogue with Russell about controlled remote viewers methodology and reassure him how you people know what you are getting is accurate. And Courtney's project, he becomes a little passionate when he talks about it. Dick did an excellent job explaining how, in that project, the viewers turned their sessions in well in advance of the tasking and the target being chosen. Russell's concern was, how do you know that they were accurate? Courtney has actually been working with the Hawaii group and Lynn's group over several projects, and as an analyst, I can say you have to know your viewers. They turn in several sessions and establish clarity scores. So you know when you have actual hands-on feedback to compare their scores.
Can you tell us what a clarity score is? What does that mean?
That's what I would term a baseline score. A clarity score is what Courtney terms it. You establish someone's accuracy by comparing their remote viewing session results against known feedback.
So that's not a double-blind experiment.
Russell, it goes beyond double-blind. The target doesn't even exist at the time that the viewers are doing their sessions. What you're talking about now is the clarity score is simply a scaling method. It's a summary scaling method that's explained in the article and so on. Russell, I'm not attacking your stuff. What is the big issue with you attacking every little thing that's going on here? So if we're trying to explain what's going on, we're just trying to explain how we do it and the advances that we've made with respect to remote viewing. Everyone's respecting the stuff that you did.
Russell's question?
Yeah, let me stop.
Russell, what is your question? You want to know how, if they're double blind?
It looks like if the target is a hurricane, then you evaluate what the guy says against the hurricane target.
Okay, Russell.
Is that correct?
Number one, the coordinates were sent to the viewers.
Back at Courtney's place has what you say. How do they determine how you did?
If those viewers turned in their sessions today and you didn't have a target chosen until 2 months from now to compare that to, that's double blind.
Yes, indeed.
All right, question. That was your first question. You asked how could that be double blind?
Okay.
So if there was no knowledge of the target.
I've got Courtney's paper in front of me, but in the interest of the goals of this program, I propose to just table this, and I'll chat with Courtney offline another day.
Good idea.
Okay.
That's a good idea. But you're also confusing two different methods of double blind. You're talking about tasking double blind versus judging blind. And so what Teresa's talking about
is... I'm concerned about.
Yeah, and what Teresa was talking about is the tasking. So you were at cross purposes. But again,
that's why I propose to drop it.
This is Dick. I'll put this in a new direction, and I'll ask this to Teresa and Lauren. And all of us. What proof? There's no proof when you're watching someone else do it. The ultimate proof is doing it yourself. You're never going to believe this until you actually do it. Don't you ladies agree that is the ultimate thing? When you do it yourself, when you produce the data and you see the feedback, that's the wow moment. And you're not really going to believe it until you do it yourself.
Well, you think, Lauren?
Lauren, can you address what do you think about site contact versus two pictures in an envelope, just to compare if you got, you know, the bridge versus the waterfall, or the bridge versus, you know, whatever. I mean, site contact, when you realize that you've had site contact, it's spectacular. You have no idea. You look at that black and white session in your hands, and it matches.
Absolutely. But going back to Dick's point, I don't think that we're talking about science and why is science being sort of a hindrance to going forward with remote viewing. And as a viewer, and as somebody who's only a viewer, I'm not interested in how long science takes to catch up with us. I just want to keep viewing. And so that's my big thing. I'm not even interested in debating why science is lagging behind. I just want to keep viewing. So that's kind of where I come from. It's kind of a moot point to me.
Behind question pertains to our understanding of what it does. I'm getting pretty old now, and my hope is that one day we'll understand how psychic ability works. That is, we're able to look into the distance and look into the future quite accurately, and the fact that we can see the future indicates that we don't understand causality, which from a physicist's point of view is quite a serious thing not to understand. And we're not going to attract smart people to try and figure this out unless we have convincing data or acceptance from the general public.
Russell brought up something interesting I want to ask everybody.
Yeah, if I could disagree there for just one moment. The understanding of the automobile and the invention of the automobile was not what changed our society. It was the acceptance of the automobile, and that acceptance came about because those people who bought automobiles when there weren't even roads or filling stations and started helping their neighbors get to the hospital and started helping their neighbors, that's what got it accepted. And how many lifetimes did we use electricity before we finally understood what it was? And it wasn't the understanding of what it was that got it accepted. It was the use of it. And like Lauren says, if the people who want to know what it is and how it works and so forth can't accept it, it's not because, you know, it's not because the thing is not real. What's going to get it accepted is getting out and actually using it to help businesses make money, help gamblers make money, help archaeologists by saying, hey, dig here and you'll find something, and by going to the police and saying, here's how to find the criminal and here's how to find the missing person. And it's the use of it that's going to get accepted, not the proof of it.
And, okay.
Well, Lynn, I agree with your principle that if people use this with great accuracy and reliability, it would have great acceptance. But in remote viewing that I've seen, the accuracy can be spectacularly rewarding, but the reliability has a lot to be wished for. So
that's,
I think,
Russell,
that until we
that's
get
what I was trying to talk to you about, Russell. I'm sorry, this is Teresa. That's exactly what I was trying to point out about Courtney's site. He has more than one project there with multiple viewer sessions, with multiple accuracy scores, and you can see their accuracy ratings. They're really very, very good, both Hawaii and Lynn's group.
Let's see, we've got a technical argument about Courtney, and I would like to drop it.
That's where the sessions are housed, if you would like to look at that.
I have it in front of me. I have his paper in front of me.
It's his site.
Okay,
caller. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Paul. We got to move on.
My bigger point here is that Democritus understood electricity at the time of the Greeks, and people did little things with electricity and got absolutely nowhere applying it until Maxwell wrote his equations, and then we were all able to use it. You could generate little arcs and sparks for 2,000 years after Democritus, and that was pretty entertaining, but until we knew how it was used, it did not get into thousands of homes.
Good point, Russell. You mentioned something about remote viewing in the future. Do we all five remote viewers here agree that remote viewers can see into the future?
Yeah, yes. Courtney proved that in that study. Yeah, we've done it at the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild. We have a number of notarized predictions that we've done on our site. We've done it a few times. It's published.
Can you see everything in the future that you target?
Can I speak to that? You can see the future as it stands now. There's a thing called paradoxical tasking that if I say, well, this happened once right after 9/11. I was contacted to predict where and when the next terrorist event would be. I told them it was going to be on the East Coast. It was going to be a water landing and so on, and told them where and when. And it actually happened, but the people were there to stop it. Therefore, the event that I predicted never happened because the future was changed. And does this mean alternate universes? I don't think so. It means that there is paradoxical tasking in that, you take actions to change the future, then the remote viewer is going to be wrong. And in a case like that, I was very happy to be wrong because it stopped a terrorist attack.
How about affecting the past? That's something that we are currently working on at Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild, is to determine whether a viewer can move. Some believe that remote viewing is just a passive act. That information only moves one direction. The question is, can it move two directions?
We did a 4-year study showing that you can absolutely influence the past, yes. Uh-huh.
Now, how does that work?
The data from many labs show that the accuracy of precognition is exactly equal to the accuracy of contemporaneous remote viewing. The people at Princeton did 500 trials showing that. Our work at SRI showed that in formal studies, it's just as easy to forecast changes in the silver a week in advance as it is to describe a picture in an envelope.
Sure.
And we did the...
How come all you guys aren't on the stock market getting rich?
Who says we're not?
I just have a lot of trouble with, I accept what Lynn says about the event never happened because he saw what could happen. I don't want to be the Mr. Skeptic here, but isn't when you take all kinds of evidence of events around you and you compute it in your own mind, don't you come up with logical conclusions? How do you know you're remote viewing? Do you see it or you hear it? You feel it? How do you know it?
I'll tell you.
We're getting to what the listeners are probably going to want to know. This is good.
Yeah, who's asking whether you can see it or hear it? Whose question is that?
That was Jerry.
You use all of your senses. You use the five normal physical senses, and getting back to Lauren here, there is also a feeling about the sight that is very important to picking up extra information about the sight, and that is called the ambiance of it. You take 100 people and walk them one at a time into a cathedral, they will all feel the ambiance, and yet there's not a body part to stick it to. And what we've actually found is the psychic sense appears to be the seventh sense, not the sixth one. And ambiance seems to be the sixth one that sort of incorporates all of the other five senses. And this is going to be the value of Lauren's book, is that she's going to start teaching people how to get that overall thing which causes what most people call when you have the revelation, when you have the revelation experience. And and so Lauren's book is going to be very valuable in this method. But you use all of your senses. You get to a point, there's one point called bilocation, which is very rare, and I would imagine that Russ has seen more of this than anyone else, and that is...
Lynn, I have somebody in the chat room which was asking about bilocation.
Yeah, in bilocation... A lot of people think that if you are picking up things about the site, then you must be at the site. And so that's bilocation. It's not. The pure bilocation is where you cannot tell that you're not at the site. You see it. You feel the wind on your face. It's full 3D Technicolor and so on. And you cannot tell you're not there.
Best done with a viewer, with an interviewer working with a viewer, so that the interviewer can help guide the person along so they don't get lost or frightened.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And we've done that. I've done that many times working with Hella Hammond on tactical targets where we would have to go into some potentially scary place, and I'd psychically hold her hand as we were breaking in.
Yeah.
So
Ingo,
I want to ask you, I agree with what you said. I want to know what you think of my comment. Our accuracy is outstanding, but our problem is reliability.
Oh, that's
so
true.
That
yeah. Well,
that corresponds to your experience?
That's yes. You know, your average score or your average accuracy is what everybody reports. Of course, some people report their highest accuracy and sort of ignore all those others. But, yeah, you have good sessions and bad sessions, and we're still trying to find out what causes you to have a good session and a bad session. Another problem with it is that you can be totally accurate. You can have a 100% accurate session, which is not applicable to what anybody needs. You know, you take the results back to a customer and they say, well, we already knew that. And so what? And so these are problems with remote viewing, that accuracy isn't the only thing. It's reliability. It's applicability. It has problems. And like I say, as long as you're using humans, it's not going to be perfect.
I would like to add something to this. And that reliability measure increases with training. It's very much like the Olympics. If you look at the people that are performing on the Olympics now, the reason they're there is not just because they can perform better than other people, but they can perform better more reliably. Now, it doesn't mean that's 100%. It doesn't mean that they don't sometimes fall off the balance beam. But on average, they do a really good job hanging in there at a much greater level of reliability than people who are just starting out.
So yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
That's the real advantage to the type of training that Lynn, Glenn, and others have been doing.
Yeah.
This long, extensive training over many years.
Well,
One of my students in Washington State wrote to me, and I mean, he was just in a horrible state, you know, just complaining and everything. And he said, I cannot seem to get over 93% accurate. And I wrote back and I said, Gritch, I don't want to hear it, you know. You know, think of what you were doing a year ago. And, you know, well, don't gritch about it.
Every,
just enjoy it.
Yeah, every session is a combination of good data, bad data, and contamination. And every viewer has good days and bad days. And every viewer has cycles of contact, has times when they're hot as a pistol, when they're really good, and other times where they can't hit the side of a barn. The key is you need a way to handle the data to determine what's the good data and what is bad. I think that's one of the important things that Glenn has taught us, is an analytical method that was used by the military and the NSA to handle the data on a low-level data, So, and that's real complicated. I don't want to get into that. The point I just wanted to make is that on a given day, I could be great, and on another day, I could be terrible.
We have a thing that we just preach to all of our students, and that is that the purpose of a practice target is not to get the target, to learn something about the target. The purpose of a practice target is to learn something about yourself.
I think that's well said, Lynn. And I have a comment that is, we did two almost perfect series in the stock market, which were judged by the market itself. So there's nobody has any quarrel about sensory leakage. And in both of those experiments, and I was a viewer in one of them, we spent a lot of time each trial debriefing any discordant elements among the viewers, the tasker, the people running the experiment. So we just had a little loving bubble, which takes some time to achieve. But in every trial, we were in complete agreement on what we're doing, why we're doing it, how it's going to be done, and then we go forward. And we found, at least in the experiments where I was the viewer with Jane, that made a huge difference, that allowed two straight-up scientists to do an almost perfect series into the stock market. But you can't. It's the idea that, in my opinion, you mustn't run viewers on trials. It's got to be exceptionally coherent, loving environment, so they're really open and willing to do this.
Sure, yeah.
We had a caller there. I don't know if they're still there or not. 559. You're on the air.
Okay, this is Jed Bendix up in Minnesota, and I had to rechange my question several times because as you guys progressed along, you answered it.
Is that a form of remote viewing, guys, when we hear this guy's been waiting on the phone, putting out vibes?
I guess
that's psychic. That's not remote viewing. What's the difference?
Yeah, we knew he was going to say that. See?
Go ahead, caller. Minnesota.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine. Teresa Frisch is my instructor, and Lynn has been gracious enough to assist a small group of us with her, and much appreciative to that. Databasing, I was wondering if Lynn has been big into that, and Teresa, wondering how all groups could get into databasing and how a scientific community can also use that as an overall with an operational plan, if there's any ideas or thought processes between the groups sharing their databases for operational and scientific purposes.
We're hoping to put a public database for remote viewing. The problem is that the first rule, of course, of databasing is garbage in, garbage out, and that most people have no idea how to use a database, much less get information out of it. So we're fighting that problem, trying to figure out how to prevent that.
Does that answer your question, caller?
Well, I'm kind of curious as to, I know Lynn's keeping watch, if the others, like the Hawaii Remote Viewing Guild and other groups, would consider combining theirs into a larger pool, separate but into a larger pool at the same time for operational and scientific purposes, where a unbiased third-party scientist could do tasking for scientific purposes, and yet at the same time operational groups could come in and for like law enforcement or medical and see which, which taskers or whatever, which groups would be best suited for their questions they're asking, either CRV, ERV, or whatever.
Yeah, Teresa is working a project on that too, to establish something like that.
Okay, any other comments?
I have a new question. About talent. Some people are better than remote viewers than others. It's a mistake to think that there's a democracy in psychic abilities.
Right.
Now, somebody talked about the balance beam last night, and I can run and swim, but I cannot do the balance beam whatsoever. So I was very interested in watching little Chinese balance beam athlete perfectly stick to the beam. Back and forth, she got a gold medal, and she did not have the slightest tremble, no balance checking. She was just glued to that beam, whereas there were other good people, there were silver people and bronze people, and people didn't get a medal, who were constantly checking their balance. But the Chinese girl did not have a balance problem. Reminded me of my large Siamese cat, who runs back and forth along a 6-foot fence along my house, and he has no problem about staying on the fence. I never saw him do a balance check. He just is glued to the fence the way the Chinese acrobat was. And I think that there may be some significant variation among remote viewers that we don't really take cognizance of, and we don't actually like to take cognizance of.
Well,
we don't like the idea that some people are A-plus remote viewers, and they're the people who get their work published in the books, and then the rest of us who are never going to do what Pat Price did because he's a different genetic composition.
That's true. There are apex viewers and there are people with more talent, but using the analogy of the Chinese gymnast, you said she was glued to the beam. I would say she probably had tremendous natural talent, and she probably also was glued to that beam throughout her life. Probably she has spent her whole life on a balance beam in China. It might, if you knew how much training she was subjected to, it might be a human rights violation. So training, talent.
And yeah, there's another factor too. And we have one viewer who does not have a lot of talent and actually ranks fairly low in almost every category of information of perceptions. However, is just a workhorse. And this woman produces like 20 pages of summary information every time she does a session. I mean, for her to do an 80-page session is nothing. And so, you know, the value of it and the accuracy of it tends to be fairly low. However, there are detectives who cannot tell you what they want and who cannot form a question because they just don't have the ability. And so what I'll do is I will task her with the generalities. She'll come back with page after page of information. I take it back to the detective, and he goes down the list saying, oh, we knew that. We don't need to know this, this. And he'll pick out five things and say, no, that's what we need to know. Then I take it back and test the other viewers accordingly. And so the different talents, you know, and not everybody who makes an average score of 70 is making that because they're all talented in the same way. Some people are better at colors. Some are better at sizes, shapes, ambiance, and such as that. And so, you know, we have a use
women,
for
women,
all the different talents.
Women view differently than men. Some people are very good at technical targets. Some people are better at emotional targets. Some people are very good at describing landscapes and scenery, and others are better at machinery.
You know,
there's a wide range.
Yeah, but in our database, I really haven't seen that. I see a pretty level playing field of interests and abilities.
How about the other three? Do you guys agree that women and men are different?
Well, actually, what the general discussion is about as a scientist is about reliability theory. Reliability theory has two elements to it. It has, are the data reliable, or is the data instrument, the instrument that's collecting the data, is it reliable, and is it valid? You can think of this as comparable to the bathroom scale that you stand on in the morning. And if the scale, let's say you weigh 170 pounds, and every time you you stand on the scale, it says 150. Now, if you stand on it every morning and it says 150, it's reliable, but it's not valid. It's not giving you the right answer. So what Lynn is talking about is that he has, with his databases, analyzed his viewers, knowing which ones are reliable and valid with respect to certain types of data. And so he has on generalists who will give some general information, but then he says, but I need now to know certain types of information, so I need to know which viewers are both reliable and valid with respect to that particular type of, that piece of information. And that's where he subtasks that out. So it's a general thing in academic circles called reliability theory that we're talking about. It's reliability and validity, two separate things.
Yeah, but Russell's question still comes back into view here, and that is, let's say I have a viewer that has 500 or 600 sessions in the database, and they've all gotten, you know, judged accurately according to the feedback and so forth, does that allow me to say on any one session, this person, you can absolutely depend on this person to produce this much accuracy? And the answer is no, because even with highly experienced remote viewers, they have good days and bad days. And so all I can say is this viewer averages this accuracy. And so, you know, if they average 70% accuracy, I could say take it with 70% dependability, but not 100%.
Now, both reliability and validity are not absolute criteria. They're both probabilistic criteria. So this is what Lynn's talking about. He has a percentage for each one.
Okay. We're going to have to take a break here. This is Jerry Pippin. This is a remote viewing special, and we'll be right back with our five remote viewers and more phone calls. First of all, I want to say you're listening to the Inception Radio Network, and this program is brought to you in part by UFOCon, being held September 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. There are 13 speakers, including some very interesting people about some incredible subjects, such as, for instance, we've talked a little bit about it earlier, but Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, has been talking to me off the record about something that he has discovered about implants and is going to reveal it publicly at that conference. And that will be, of course, in the middle of September, and it's 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. If you want to get more information, simply go over to the website, and let me give you that address right now. That's UFOCon2012.com. We have Dr. Courtney Brown, Russell Targ, Lynn Buchanan, Dick Auger, and, of course, the only woman on the panel, but we did have a caller that gave the female reaction a little more. Lauren Cott from Calgary, Canada is with us as well. We'll go to the phones again here in a minute, but I had a caller who finally gave up, and they sent me an email. And I apologize to you if you have to wait so long, but this is a very interesting conversation. We need to give all five panelists a chance to say something. But all five of you can answer this question that they were going to ask on the phone, and that is having dreams and then coming true, is that a form of remote viewing, or is that just something different?
It's a form of your subconscious talking to you.
Okay. How about the rest of you?
Certainly a kind of psychic abilities. It shows that one of the first contacts with psychic ability that people have is through their dreams. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can have dreams of the future shows that the future is available to us. And the thing to learn is to be able to separate out the previous day's residue and wish fulfillment from the unique and preternaturally clear aspects that signify a precognitive dream. So you don't want to view every dream as precognitive. You want to develop the skill to tell which ones are your wish fulfillment dreams and which ones are brought to you by the future.
Okay, that's Russell's viewpoint. How about the rest of you?
This is Dick in Hawaii. I would agree with Lynn that it is your subconscious communicating with you, and when you're asleep or nearly asleep, your conscious mind is being quiet enough that your subconscious can speak to you. And one of the reasons I remote viewing, when I heard about it, sparked an interest in me was that I had had dreams in the past that were not precognitive, but I dreamt of something I shouldn't know about that was later verified. So when I heard about remote viewing, I went, wow, maybe that explains what this is. So, yeah, it's communication with your subconscious.
Yeah, and in dreams, your subconscious uses a lot of symbology and visualizations and so on, example-type stuff and symbolism. And this also happens in remote viewing. One of the reasons that a lot of people don't understand the clarity issue in remote viewing is because they don't understand that even in your waking state, when your subconscious wants to talk to you, it's going to use a lot of symbology and a lot of things like that.
This is Courtney now. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Lauren.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to say that I agree with what everyone else has said, but I would add that I've heard it reported that a lot of remote viewers find that their dreams are enhanced through the process of learning to remote view because you develop a relationship with your subconscious so that it learns to speak to you or with you at times when you're dreaming. So a lot of people find that your dreams become more vivid or more useful or even more precognitive just by the very fact that you do remote view. I'd say that this is precognitive dreaming, but it's sort of a side effect that I've heard in a lot of cases that remote viewers will have more vivid dreams as a result of remote viewing.
Yeah, and as your subconscious grows from an inner child to an inner adult, you'll find that the quality, I'm just going to throw that word in, quality of your dreaming becomes more valuable to you.
And the way to perfect that is to keep a notebook by the side of your bed and make a note about your dream before you get up to wash your face or go to the bathroom. Because the dream memories are erased by the big muscle motions. So if you want your dream, I promise you that your dream life will become much more interesting as soon as you start making notes of your dreams.
Keeping notes, yeah. Oh, sorry, Courtney.
You go first, Dick.
I just wanted to say this while it's fresh. Keeping notes is a good idea. When you become proficient at remote viewing, it's a good idea to keep a journal because everything you think during the day matters, and everything you think affects things. And you'll find that you'll have random thoughts that you'll later understand had maybe important meaning, and it's a good idea to write those things down as your remote viewer. Oh, sorry, Courtney, go ahead with your
dream. No, it's okay. That was great. My take on dreams is a bit more theoretical, but the dreams as I understand them, as I think about them, is understandable if you think in terms of quantum mechanics. Nothing on the quantum level happens or unless it's registered or observed in some way. And the idea that observing makes something pop into reality from a probabilistic ether makes it understandable that thought actually can create the reality that we see. Now, when you expand this to the issue of dreams, what happens when we dream is our brain shuts down. Our physical brain quiets down. And my thought is that what we're actually seeing, I'm not saying I can prove this or anything, but my interpretation, my thought of, is that when we are actually dreaming, we are getting a glimpse into a much vaster reality that we came from before we were physical beings, meaning our soul, if you want to call it that, or our subspace aspect, whatever you want to call it, the non-physical self, actually lives the way we lived before we became physical beings with all these constraints that we have working through the biochemistry of a brain computer. And when you wake up, that tremendous amount of information of stuff that was going on can't all fit into the brain. The bandwidth getting into the brain is just enough. It's just not enough. So as soon as you start using the brain for other stuff, that information just can't survive. And so that's why the note-taking is actually useful. But the idea that thoughts can create reality can be best understood in terms of precognitive stuff is that in the dream world, there would be no time delay. Whereas in the physical world, there would be a time delay as events have to work their way into our current manifestations, our current present now, in order to get to us. So that precognitive aspect of dreams is actually possible with that interpretation of dreams.
Now, this brings me up to something I wanted to ask earlier. All five of you, I think, would probably agree that there is some resistance to remote viewing in some circles in the scientific community. Is that true? Or does... Well,
That's exactly what I was talking about when I said I am the only academic that studies the subject of remote viewing as it's done using those military or military derived procedures.
Okay.
The resistance is palpable.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to ask Russell something because he told me one time that he had went to a conference and met some government people, started talking to them about it. And that's how I got funding for some of these things. Russell, I'm paraphrasing and making a few shortcuts here, but was it very difficult to get the CIA and the Pentagon interested in funding you on these projects?
It was not very difficult.
That's strange. I would think it would be really hard.
Hal and I were both known as we were laser physicists who had published papers in the scientific literature. And before we went to the CIA, we had done two formal experiments with double-blind judging. That is, what the viewers had to say were randomly matched to the actual targets. That is, when the person said, "I see Hoover Tower," the judge then had to look at nine other targets and say, which of those matches Hoover Tower? And they would pick Hoover Tower. So it was the blind matching. Our judging corresponded exactly to what's used in medical and scientific literature, so they could totally take on board that we had done something at odds of one in a million, even though we only did nine trials. They just understood what we had done was easy to communicate, and the head of CIA, John McMahon, said, "Well, I understand what you've done here. We have a target we want you to look at. If you can describe our target, we'll support your program." That was the story.
And you did it.
And we did it.
And
you
never
did it. We did the experiment, and Pat Price nailed the target.
Yeah, that happened many times in the military unit. Senators and congressmen would come by. See, we were only funded for 1 year at a time. And we had to prove ourselves every single year in order to get funded again. And we would have a senator or congressman come by, and they would bring a target that one of their aides had sealed in an envelope, and they had no idea what it was and so on. And we would sit down and remote view it, and then they would take our session out, you know, our session summary, and and open the envelope to see what the target was, and we got funded every year simply because we were able to describe a target sealed in an envelope when even they didn't know what it was. But they would always come not knowing what the target is, because that's the proper way to do it. If they had known what the target was, there would have been some kind of pollution in their reaction to anything we said or something like that. And so, you know, this was the real necessity for having the double blind situation.
Can I throw in a funny story about that as a journalist? When my day job is a television reporter, and I'm interested in remote viewing and fairly knowledgeable about that. So I was on a news assignment interviewing a U.S. senator, I won't say who, but he's a well-known U.S. senator. And I knew that he had been on the Intelligence Committee that was given a demonstration of remote viewing. And based upon that, he was quite amazed and funded a program. So I was at an event where I was interviewing him on a completely different subject. And I asked him the questions that I needed for my story that day. And when the camera was still rolling, I said, "Senator, I understand you were on the Intelligence Committee when remote viewing was demonstrated to you, and you saw it successfully done. Can you tell me about that?" The look he gave me was priceless. If he could have struck me down, I have that video somewhere in my files, but he was not happy to have that question asked with a television camera rolling. I didn't put that on
the air. I dubbed a copy for myself, but
did he answer it?
No, of course not. He, he just gave me a really dirty look and sidestepped.
I'd like to take 1 minute for shameless commerce and have people who want to write to me at my website. I have a website, espresearch.com. I'm happy to have people ask me questions or see what I'm up to. And what I'm up to is just publishing a brand new book talking about the previously classified program. The book is called The Reality of ESP, and it shows you what we did and describes how to learn to do it.
Okay, interesting subject. I got somebody here on the chat room who brought up astral projection. Wanted to know if that's connected to remote viewing or not.
Well,
anybody
know? Well, the continuum from remote viewing to out-of-body experience. And in our lab, we generally did not encourage people to have out-of-body experiences because Hal and I are physicists, and we were always afraid that if somebody, if someone suddenly found themselves with their consciousness separated from their body, they would have a frightening experience or couldn't get reintegrated. And we only needed one person to go back to our management and say, "Targ popped me out of my body and I can't get myself back together." That would have been the end of the program.
Anybody but else people, try that?
But people, there is a continuum where you can commit more of your emotionality, sensitivity, and sexuality and experience these exciting things that Aleister Crowley and Bob Monroe talked about. But there is sex on the astral plane, but there's a risk that you'll have a frightening experience when you go that route.
There's another way to look at this, and that is that out-of-body experiences, as they are done in safe environments, such as at the Monroe Institute in Faber, Virginia, often have an enriching early experience growth period for early remote viewers, people who are just learning. For example, when you start the remote viewing process, you're learning everything from scratch. My experience has been that people who then, after starting to learn remote viewing, go to some place like the Monroe Institute and take a week-long course, or and perhaps their gateway experience course, or their gateway course, in residence course, they in 1 week have a great deal of experiences of a great deal of variety, and then when they come back to the remote viewing training, they are not doing out-of-body stuff. But that week at the Monroe Institute, I have found tremendously enriches them, and they become better remote viewers as a consequence.
Lauren, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I agree with what you've said, but I don't believe that they teach out-of-body experience in the Gateway program. I think out-of-body experiences are considered a somewhat shaky or advanced operation, and they're not going to take the multitudes of gateway people and have them take part in an out-of-body.
As Lynn Buchanan said, Lauren Cott, what do you think of all this?
Yeah.
She's not going to answer.
I guess. Actually, the Gateway Institute, the Gateway course, does try to get you to go out-of-body and under controlled conditions. And they do sort of put this to the masses. I was very surprised. The military put me through the Gateway military course, and that's exactly what they had us there doing. Yeah.
Lynn, do you think anybody in the military is doing this stuff now?
You know, once you retire, they quit telling you things.
Mm-hmm.
As my standard answer is that, you know, people ask me, is the military still doing remote viewing? And my standard answer is that I hope so, because it is such an effective tool, and it's such a tool, you know, for gaining information that can't be gained anywhere else, and that it would be stupid of the government not to have it anymore. But then that changes the question from the remote viewing to, does our government ever do anything stupid? And I'm afraid I already know the answer to that one, you know. Lauren, is your microphone off?
It was off.
Okay.
But now it's on. About
we wanted you to put your 2 cents in.
Yeah. I understand that they do, through the Gateway program at Monroe, they do remote viewing, a type of remote viewing, extended remote viewing. Is that correct? Lynn, you would probably know. For my money, and I'm all for out-of-body experiences, but for my money, I think it's just, it's more effective. I'm not more effective. I won't say that. It's just, it makes a lot more sense in terms of everyday applications to not have to go into an out-of-body experience in order to do a session. The kind of sessions that we do through controlled remote viewing, you can do them at a Denny's, you can do them in an airport or on a plane, and you don't have to go out of body. And so out-of-body is great, but you just don't have to. So if you want to save that for special occasions or whatever.
Yeah.
But
Ingo makes a point of this too. He says that if you have a bi-location experience or an out-of-body experience to do the remote viewing, mm-hmm. you come back and you write a pale summary of what happened. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you don't have that, then we have the monitor who's there getting details from you. And those details are much more valuable than the pale summary.
Which is a great thing, too, if somebody does have the occasion to use a monitor, but I think a lot of people who are currently remote viewers don't always have the luxury of having a monitor. So that's the other part.
Yeah, well, that brings up an interesting point. Is this kind of morphing into a Lone Ranger activity? You do by the internet, take lessons, or is it still got some scientific basis or reality?
Well, it still
basis.
Has scientific basis, but it's also, you know, the military, one thing the military has is people. You know, it has plenty of people. But and so we always had access to monitors, analysts, report writers, project managers, and so on. And the person who just comes, takes a course, and then goes home may learn how to remote view, but they don't have, like Russell was saying, they don't have the monitor there to guide them, to hold them to the structure, and to help them into a session and to hold their hand all the way through it. And so, unfortunately, yeah, it's becoming sort of a Lone Ranger type thing. Not saying a lawless type thing, but a lone type thing. For most people, yeah.
Well, now you still use a group of people to task things. I know that from personal experience.
Well, but they're all over the world, and I mean, for any one project for us, it's I may have one viewer in Canada, one in Japan, one in Yemen, 3 in the States, and of course they have no real connection with each other. Just 1 second.
I can also add that many of Lynn's students have worked at projects that were conducted at the Farsight Institute, as well as the HRVG people, and all of the sessions that are done have been done solo, without a monitor at all. And that's one of the good things about the training that Lynn and Glenn Wheaton have been doing. Their viewers are that good that they don't need monitors. They can do these sessions solo.
Okay, we're going to, I'm going to get to some interesting questions here and some more phone calls. We do have an open line.
I got a quickie for Courtney and for Lynn. How would you, I think I'm giving up for this lifetime to have you guys do formal experiments. I'll never bring it up again. Instead, I'd like you to see if you can demonstrate your CRV prowess forecasting the stock market.
In Dublin,
would that interest you?
Well, in Dublin, we had a I was on a radio show, and they were talking about ARV, And so I just put the rules of ARV out to the listeners. He had 27,000 people predicting the stock for 2 days in a, 2 days into the future. And I think it was 47% of those predicted the correctly. And of the others, I think it was 26% said the stock will go down or it won't change. So there were three options. And 47% said the stock will go up, and sure enough, the stock went up. And so, you know, this was probably the largest just ad hoc experiment of this kind, but he had 27,000 listeners who accurately predicted the stock for 2 days in advance.
Would that interest you as being, would you like to take that for a homework assignment to report on at the next IRVA conference?
I could. I've really got, I think, more important things to do.
I think that would be a huge plus for the credibility, because when we did that in the 80s, we got... That is, our silver forecasting is what stimulated the BBC and Nova to make a film about remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some people actually making money in the market would be a huge plus. In agreement with what you said, we may not know how it works, but if you can do it well enough to make money in the market, you will change the way people viewed it.
Yeah,
in my opinion, we failed in our replication. We did not succeed the following year for a number of reasons that I don't have to go into now. My opinion is that if we had gotten 9 in a row the following year, then the world would be a different place.
So, Russell, let me ask you, this is Dick, let me ask you a question. Are you saying that you had some success doing silver futures and stock market, and in recent years you had a fall off in performance of the viewers?
I'm saying that in 84, I did a series of 9 formal trials with an investor, putting tens of thousands of dollars into the market on each viewing. We did 9 of those in a row correctly, up a little, up a lot, down a little, down a lot. So each of them were 1 in 4, and we were correct on all 9 of them. And we made $120,000 in the market.
In more recent years, like in the last 5 to 6 years,
I want to be clear. The following year, we failed because we were having to do it twice as fast, and the viewer wasn't getting feedback on the session he just did until later on. And we weren't successful. In 95, Jane and I did a formal series where we were right 11 out of 12.
How about most recently? Have you been doing some work
That was our last forecast. It required really a lot of psychic attention and energy. What we wanted to do is see, could we really do that with redundancy coding? That is to say, we had to agree on what the target was. We had to do 18 trials. We agreed 12 times, and of the 12 times we agreed, 11 of those were correct.
I thought you were doing some work recently with Skip Atwater, or that wasn't you?
Not I.
That was Marty Rosenblatt, and Marty comes every year to the conference and presents what they've been doing. And this is, you know, taking this as homework and presenting it at IRVA. My problem with that is, one, it's already been done, and two, it would be mainly a duplication of Marty's work, because he always presents at IRVA. By the way, for the listeners, International Remote Viewers Association, IRVA.
They have a convention, they just have it, or is it coming up?
They have it once a year, and it's usually on Father's Day, and I think it's going to be on Father's Day weekend coming year, too. Yeah.
Let me ask.
Las Vegas. It's in Las Vegas because actually for travel, that winds up being one of the cheapest places to travel to.
And the remote viewing conference, if you like this conversation here, it's nonstop conversations like this out in the hall and over dinner and in the rooms. It's big fun meeting Lynn and everyone and just talking like this. Let me throw a question out to the other people on the panel. Is it ethical to use a remote viewer to take their sessions and use their sessions for the stock market or betting or something without telling them you're doing it?
This is what's called hijacking a session. I don't think it's ethical. I would never do it with anyone, but it has been done, and I hear it's been done successfully.
I don't think it'll be successful very long because you're lying to your viewer. You're counting on your viewer to be omniscient in the world, and then you, in your little secret world, are trying to lie to him. I think that's a counterproductive plan.
That's right. And you know, if you're trying to predict, will the stock go up, down, or remain the same? Okay, let's say that the stock is going to go up, and you have set the goal of, if the stock is going to go up, this person will make a low score on their session, or will miss the target altogether. The person misses the target altogether, and they wind up thinking, oh, I'm dog meat, I'm pig slop, and all that. I can't remote view. When actually, they have predicted the real tasking, not the tasking they were given. And I think it's unethical.
Okay, let's move on. I want to get to Mars. That's coming up next. But I'm going to take a break first. This program, Remote Viewing Special, is brought to you in part by UFOCon. And this is something really you might think about attending, especially if you're on the West Coast, but any place really. It's always nice to take a trip to California. Are you curious about things like extraterrestrials, UFOs, alien abductions, implants? Well, even the secret space program, does it really exist? Area 51 and many other UFO topics? Well, never fear. It's here, almost. September 15th and 16th, the answers will be there all weekend long at the UFOCon in California in Santa Clara. 13 speakers, all with credentials and all with very interesting subjects. As I mentioned earlier, Douglas Dietrich will be talking about some never-before-heard information about Roswell. Same with Daryl Sims, the alien hunter. He's got some never-before-heard new evidence on implants. In addition to that, Chris O'Brien will be there talking about how you can set up your camera and get pictures of UFOs around UFO hotspots. Laura Eisenhower will tell us about her almost mission to Mars. And we'll find that pretty interesting. In addition to that, joining them are Richard Dolan, Alfred Weber, and in addition to Alfred, we have Jordan Maxwell. I don't want to leave him out. And Michael Sherratt, and also five other speakers. Plus, you'll meet some special guests like Sean David Morton. And also, we will have John Wells there. Actually, I think he'll be broadcasting Saturday night from Coast to Coast AM. So if you want to go over to that website or write it down and go there when you can, it's UFOCon2012.com. In other words, it's very simple, UFOCon, all one word, 2012.com. Okay, can you remote view life on other planets? Can you sit down and look and see if there's life on Mars? Courtney, didn't you do something like that?
Well, when you talk about something like that, you're talking about something that's speculative because you don't have the ability to verify that the remote viewing data are accurate. But sometimes it's very important to do that because you want to establish the data publicly with the expectation that at some point in the future, verification will be possible. And when that occurs, you want to be able to have a publication record that says X, Y, and Z. The trouble is that while you're waiting, you are the object of scorn. People look at you and say, you know, this stuff is out there. Well, remote viewing itself is out there. And I don't have any trouble having remote viewing applied to extraterrestrial issues and then waiting however long it takes. Other people do have trouble doing that. And I'd like at this point, before I go on, to ask Lynn to chime in, because Lynn has the same types of reservations, in my view, that Glenn Wheaton also has with respect to using remote viewing to study extraterrestrial life, because it brings in a woo-woo factor that can degrade the seriousness with which remote viewing itself is looked at. And so Glenn Wheaton and Lynn Buchanan, in my view, really want to focus on getting a remote viewing accepted without bringing in that extra woo-woo factor, even if the extra woo-woo factor is correct. My view is a little different. I'm looking at a longer perspective and thinking that I'd rather deal with criticism now and get the perceptions in public so that at some point in time they will have that beneficial response. There's no right answer to that, Jerry.
What did you see?
Well, we mostly do formal scientific studies at the Forest Site Institute, dealing with things in the nature of physical reality, the nature of time, things like that, with all conceivable scientific controls that have ever been. I mean, we pull out all the stops with respect to the level of controls that we apply. However, sometimes we also do operational targets, and in one particular project that we did a project that was based on an anomaly that was on Mars. And that project we did only because there was an exceptionally clear, very high resolution photograph that was NASA, JPL, Malin Space Science Systems, and Origin. And it showed what appeared to be a horizontal spray, like a geyser, but it was horizontal, coming out of what appeared to be a straight pipe that was connected to what appeared to be a pipeline leading to a dome. Now, the spray itself was unusual because I knew of no geological processes that would produce a horizontal spray. There was a shadow underneath it, so it was pretty clear it was a spray. The picture was really remarkable. And so it was that spray that led me to think that this would be a good idea for a project. And we did that project with the Mars Anomaly project. And in that particular case, the remote viewers went in all solo, totally blind. They had no physical or verbal contact with the tasker, just an email saying, there's a target, go do it. So they went in without any contact from anybody. They did the sessions. They had not been given any off-planet or those types of targets before from me for years. It had all been normal, verifiable, on-Earth-type targets. So that was totally unexpected. And they came back with remarkable data. And all the data are available to see on the Forest Site Institute's website. And the DVD, The Forest Site Experiments, actually has a section on it that in detail describes the results and puts it all together. And the remote viewers described the spray in absolutely unambiguous terms. Some described the chemical composition of the spray, the pipeline, the nozzle, and when they saw the dome, they did what these trained remote viewers do, which is they saw something and they went inside and investigated it. Now, Dick Allgaier was one of the viewers for that project, so he can talk about some of his sessions. But what I want to emphasize is that I wanted this study to be public for the record. It's got a very good image a really good image, physical image, really good remote viewing data that match the image. So now what we're doing is we're waiting. And at some point in time, we will have verification on whether this these remote viewing data are accurate. But even now, you can say that they're very accurate with respect to matching what you see in the picture. But this has to be considered speculative until it's finally resolved. But on the other hand, it's really great to have that type of project done for the record so that at some point in time when some type of verification can come in, we can at least say, yes, this was done. We don't have to try to convince people that we did it but kept it secret.
Maybe we have Dick has emailed me one of those Mars images, and that will appear on our website when this interview shows up there in a couple of days.
Courtney,
Dick, you, what about it? What can you say about it?
Well, I did the target blind. I had no idea what it was. It was, hey, work a target for Courtney. And I did our protocol methodology, and at one point I closed my eyes and looked, and what I saw, I just sent the image. You can see what I sketched.
I'm looking at it.
I saw the thing he was looking at, but I would say one of the last people you should ask about a session is the viewer, because sometimes the viewer doesn't know.
You have a note down here that something's liquid underneath there and under pressure.
At Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild, I mean, it looked to me, and I got a sense of liquid under pressure. That doesn't mean it's there. I could have been wrong. That's a very interesting image.
Yes, it is.
I
say we'll be posting that later.
I know a really, really, really good former military remote viewer that I was talking to about 8-9 years ago who said, oh, I just did an interesting target. And he said it was a lake. I was standing next to a lake. I said, so what? Why was that so interesting? He said, it was on Mars. And pictures have just come out of, supposedly there's liquid water on Mars. But anyway, my sketch and the target photograph is, I just emailed it out so you can publish, and I'll publish that without comment. I don't really know.
Okay, we understand
if,
that.
If I could comment about what Courtney said, Glenn and I are both very careful to try to keep the woo-woo away from the remote viewing that so many people are so quick to attach to it. However, I'm kind of torn in this because my first bilocation experience was I found myself standing on the surface of Mars, and it was about a year later that I was at a location which still had a, you know, physically at a location, and they had a picture which at the time was classified, and it was exact feedback. It was right where I'd been. I have done several things for space exploration and moon exploration. Ingo Swann predicted the what the Jupiter probe would see 17 years before the Jupiter probe actually entered the atmosphere. He was correct.
Publish Ingo's narrative in my new book, The Reality of ESP. So I have his whole narrative on the Jupiter rings and the NASA pictures of the Jupiter rings.
Yeah. About 15 years ago, I was doing a project for a space exploration, and I found the red sands and all of this. I realized in my session I was back on Mars, and yet all of a sudden I found a metallic scoop laying on the ground. And so it was this last year that I got actual picture feedback of the scoop. It is not an Earth, you know, from any of the Earth equipment, and it is an artifact on Mars, and there is a picture of it taken by JPL, and I got that actual feedback 15 years later. I was tasked by Moon Exploration Company to describe the first temporary moon base that would be used for building the first permanent, you know, to house the workers to build the first permanent moon base. And we described it, and my friend at JPL sent me a thing just recently. It was a flyover of the moon, a fairly recent one, and there was a stop, one frame, and it was enlarged, and there is that base that I described. And so, yeah, this is very possible, and yet, where is that line where it goes from the actual scientific prediction of what's out there to the woo-woo? And that is what Courtney was saying, that Glenn and I are both very careful about, because this is not woo-woo.
Yeah, we understand. But however, you did task the Aztec UFO crash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you still stand by what you originally saw? Have you investigated that more?
Yeah, we had very top quality viewers on that, and I still stand by it, yeah.
And for our listeners who haven't heard that interview, it's on our website at jerrypippin.com.
Yeah, Aztec being a city in New Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, and you even... I don't know how else to say it. There was somebody shot at an ET.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, uh-huh.
And at least one.
Yeah.
And so you had 12, I think, remote viewers. You tasked them, and
yeah,
most of them came up with similar things.
Yeah, and, you know, the ETs are just like remote viewing. I mean, you really can't. You know, it's really dumb to deny their existence anymore.
Let's, we've got about 7 minutes left on the show, so let's go around the table here and see if anybody wants to make a comment about everything. And I think I'll start with Miss Scott. She's been quiet again.
Yeah.
You got any final comments?
I have really no final comments, other than it's just been a really great experience and pleasure to be with everybody, and I appreciate being asked on.
Let me ask you, do women do remote viewing any differently than men? Do they find different things?
I don't think so. I've never come across that. I mean, I think the subconscious belonging to any person is going to see different sorts of things. And it doesn't have to do with gender. It has to do with what the subconscious goes out and looks for. So I don't think it's a gender thing at all.
Yeah, Russell, you're like me. I ask that question all the time, and evidently the consensus is that maybe this is one place where there's not much difference in the sexes. What do you think, though?
Well, I only worked with two women extensively. I worked with Hella and one of our contract monitors in the CIA, and they turned in outstanding, pristine, accurately items. The first presentation of our CIA lady in my new book, where she drew a merry-go-round divided in six segments and went on and on. I show what she drew and what she said about it. And Hella, of course, was outstanding. And
Lauren, before we let you off of here, you got any thing? You can't plug the book yet. It's not out. You got anything else you want to talk about?
I can't plug the book, but anyone who's interested in keeping track of the book's progress is welcome to look at my website, which is laurencott.com, laurencott.com, and I'll hopefully be putting more information on that as soon as I can.
Okay, Russell, you got any parting comments? You need to mention the book and your website.
Well, my website is espresearch.com. You can tell how long ago I put that up to have that available. espresearch.com, and I'm happy to answer queries to people who write to me. And my new book is The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. And I deliver on the proof of what it is and how to do it.
Okay. Lynn Buchanan, any parting comments?
Yeah, let me mention two things. One of our students, Dr. David Shaver, is a psychoanalyst, a very high-ranking psychoanalyst, and he is now writing a book on the writings of Jung, Freud, Paul Tillich, and other philosophers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and all that, showing the what they had found about telepathy, ESP, and all that, and showing that in the psychological field, it's been accepted for years and years. The other thing I would like to talk about is that if one of the listeners is wanting to learn remote viewing, be very careful. Like Russell said, there are some millions of pages, and many of them are charlatans. Many of them are people who have jumped onto the remote viewing bandwagon, and they are undisciplined psychics, which is not a bad thing, you know, if they have the talent. But they're going to teach you undisciplined things, and that is not remote viewing. Remote viewing is a scientific discipline. So be very careful before you put a dollar down as to who it is you're training with. And
Dick Allgaier, what about you?
First, I want to say that I think women are different. I'm going to get myself in trouble, but women are different. Thank goodness. I'm so glad they are. Some of the best, probably the three best remote viewers I know are women that I've worked with. But I just say that we understand the skill. We're beginning to understand it. We've proved it. And now it's time to realize the potential. So it's time for us to do something significant with this. Let's get to work, and let's all work together. That's one good thing Courtney's been doing, is getting viewers across methodologies and schools to work in unison. And with that, I'll say aloha.
Okay, Courtney, you started off the show. You can end it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone for participating. And Russell, your comments have been valuable. There's nothing better than a good debate to get people thinking. And so that has been really great. The audience, I would like to encourage to take a look at the studies that we've been doing over the years at the Farsight Institute. There's a number of easy places to get easy access to what we've been doing. The first is the DVD, The Farsight Experiments, which summarizes and ties together all of the work that we've been doing over the last 5 years in major projects, and it's a good way to get going. There's also the peer-reviewed published research that's just recently come out. I differ with Russell. I don't think anyone can competently read an article like that while you're having a radio interview. So sit down with the article and read it carefully, including the discussions of the control group issue and so on. And then I would like people to note there's also a book. I have the book Remote Viewing, The Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception. It's the only book of its kind that deals with the science of remote viewing as it is done using these structured data collection procedures that were developed by the military or procedures that are derivative of those procedures. So we have a DVD, published research, both book and peer-reviewed articles, and we have tons of fully blown-out experiments, projects that we've done that are on the Institute's website that you can dive into. Once you get into it, you'll be amazed at how far this, what I call second, third generation scientific research has actually gone. And it's a very exciting time to be introduced to it.
Okay, I appreciate all of you being on. Our time's up, and you'd think 3 hours would cover everything, but we haven't, unfortunately. So maybe we'll do another show. You never know. Thanks very much, everybody. This has been a remote viewing special, and it's been brought to you by UFOCom, and that is being held September 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. and they have 13 speakers on all kinds of subjects, and I think you'll find it very interesting. Simply go over to their website, ufocon2012.com. I'd like to thank everybody at Inception Radio and Jane Swartley, our producer, as well, for helping us put this show together. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening. Cheers.